You're listening to the Liminalist, the podcast between, and I am Jason Horsley. This week I'm talking to Panu from Finland, who I connected with through a mutual relationship with Deva Shana. I mean, it is the place to start, logically, and it's where we started, but I'm also, I don't want to push you too much about Dave, because you're not participating anymore, and I don't know. So, how much do you want to talk about Dave?
It's interesting, it's a good question, and I'm thinking, I don't talk about him, usually. With people. Like I don't actively kind of process the whole thing or the time that I spent in his retreats and teaching in general. But I know that like contacting you, that would be the thing. That would be the thing in common.
Yeah.
So I'm open to discussing it.
Okay.
Well, I think one of the interesting things that I noticed sometime that going to his retreats, that many of the people who were there were like heavily into Castaneda. Before, and that's interesting because listening to you, you have been like, you've been heavily into Castaneda,
yeah,
and I was like very involved, very enthusiastic about all these dream experiences and stuff like that at some point in my life, so that's somehow interesting. In this point of my life, I'm not like actively interested in any of that. I don't know if it's like, it's not valid at this point of my life to my life.
Right.
But as a thing, you know, like these kind of people, they like this kind of stuff, and that's why they go to the here, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wasn't aware of that. That was where I was about to go anyway, was to Castaneda, because you mentioned it in your email. So we're in sync there. But I wasn't aware. I was only aware of one person who I think was on the first retreat I went to who was into Castaneda. I won't mention names, but that's all. And I didn't know for yourself, except when you sent the email some weeks ago.
I've met like from 5 to 10 people, like, and people, they don't advertise it, but when you start to talk with them, then suddenly someone who doesn't, you know, they don't look like it, that they've read the books, but then when you talk with them, you can suddenly pick it up there, that they've been into that stuff also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it is an interesting thing. I mean, we're on the same page there in terms of not considering those writings or that interpretation of the world particularly relevant or valid today. And one of the reasons, as you know, that I feel that way is because I took it and I ran with it. So there was a decade or two even. Probably two decades, really, almost, where I was doing the Castaneda thing as far as one can without actually, you know, meeting an ancient Toltec sorcerer, which I never managed to find. I just improvised my own version, and I did meet a teacher here and a teacher there. And certainly I did a lot of the psychedelic use, but I also attempted to practice some of them. I mean, most of Castaneda isn't really practical. or practicable, right? Even things that supposedly are like the recapitulation just seem so unrealistic, right? That
Did you have the did you have that kind of feeling? Would you say that it was a waste of time, those years, or some of it? Would you say it was wasting your time,
I'm not sure about a waste
looking
of
back?
time. I mean, time's a funny thing, hey, because I definitely, I mean, as I've said on many podcasts, and including the last one with my niece, that there's no teacher like failure, and there's no wisdom, there's no substitute for the wisdom that comes from making mistakes. So I think it's a valid use of time to try things out and find out that they don't work. That's even one of the definitions of the spiritual path, that neti neti thing, right? But as terms of energy, I do think I squandered a lot of energy, because of the things I was doing. So it wasn't so much the use of time per se, but the use of my body, I think. So, but for example, I mean, because I mentioned the recapitulation as an example of something that's incastinated, which just seems crazily kind of disconnected from reality. And for people who don't know, it's like the recapitulation, you're supposed to recapitulate your whole life down to every last thought that you ever had, everyone you ever met,
Like
every,
all your mem go back all your memories and
yeah, every last memory, including thoughts and dreams and all the rest of it. And clearly, that's a crazy endeavor and could even drive a person crazy if they really committed to it. But I was never, I mean, I never took anything as gospel, not even the gospel, right? So even though I live by castaneda more than any other system or writings or what have you, when it came to actually try and apply it, I was always very loose and gonzo about it. And so with the recapitulation, I just took the template, which is I wrote down as many people and places I could remember, and then I used that to just send my attention, as a meditation. I remember doing it in nature when I was living in the wilderness for a period, just spending hours a day kind of lying on the grass, sending my consciousness back or my thoughts back to the past. And I think that was fruitful in its own way.
I think some of it can be useful, but like the context is so blurry somehow. And also like he was like revealed to be a cultist and sexual abuser and stuff like that, so the source wasn't the most reliable,
That's right.
because like you wouldn't trust that guy like by his merits.
No, and I've written about this so that yeah, if water's coming through a dirty or toxic or a rusty pipe, then it's going to be the water itself is going to be contaminated by that. So yeah, whatever we got via Castaneda, we can gauge its merit to some degree by Castaneda himself. I did the same with Whitley Strieber, but it doesn't actually. It's an interesting conundrum because it doesn't compromise exactly or invalidate the information per se. It just invalidates the interpretation and the way it's being presented. And I think even one can even make the argument, and I have, that it might validate the experiences that are being presented insofar as they were real enough to derange a person.
It has to have something that you can like, it has to have something that you grasp on, that you get hooked or something. And I think to me now, like I got this idea now that if something is entertaining, then it's a little bit like then it's already a little bit suspicious. Like if something's entertaining, then it's like, why like isn't there enough substance here? Why do they need why do they need the like why do they have the need to entertain? Like if I if, So like they are quite, Castaneda books are quite entertaining.
They certainly are, yeah. I mean, that was what
Yeah,
got me.
yeah.
I just steamed through them. I read them back to back in a period of weeks,
Yeah.
and that was, and before I'd even finished the series, I decided to learn Spanish and move to Mexico.
So you really went far with it.
Yeah, and that was because of how entertaining they were, essentially. As in, they were, I mean, entertaining perhaps isn't a strong enough word. They were spell binding. They cast a
Yeah,
spell.
they kind of like they suck you in somehow into that world. They're very absorbing.
Yeah.
Like they create this image of like I don't know, infinite possibilities or stuff like that. But there's also this realistic or like this like I really liked that. That was what I liked about Castaneda was that it, like Don Juan always presented in the book, he always said that there's just limited amount of time and limited amount of energy, and you have to like decide what to do with it or make the best use of it. So that's like the practical side of the Castaneda,
Yeah.
which was quite some, like, even though the other side of it like was very unbelievable, then he like injected some of like really good principles in the mix, so it was easier to swallow the other stuff also. I don't know, but some of the principles were like, there was like good stuff in the mix. I don't know.
Yeah, I think particularly Journey to Ixtlan, which was the stuff that he left out of the first two books, because I mean, if we're taking him at his word, which obviously is very risky, but let's just do it for now, just for simplicity's sake, he claimed that he left out all of the content of Journey to Ixtlan initially because he thought the focus was on the power plants or the entheogens. And then Journey to Ixtlan, the third book, which was the book he got his PhD for, was all of the more philosophical stuff. And I think it's one of the strongest books for that. And I mean, yeah, I think that even to this day, I still somewhat live by principles in there, like death as an advisor was one that's really was really strong, and that I wouldn't say I consciously practice. I'd say I'd have internalized. I think there are teachings in those books that are absolutely sound, and that I was able to internalize them over the years, and that they have been useful. But as you say, they're mixed up with the tales of power, the quest for power. That's really intoxicating about those books is you can turn into a crow, you can fly, you can hang out with, beautiful witches, and just the intoxication of that, of entering into a world, as you say, of infinite possibilities. That there's no way to internalize that, and it creates a an impossible standard, I'd say, for spiritual seeking is like I've got to learn to fly, if I
Yeah,
can.
exactly. They are exciting fantasy, but I don't know if the like I think the cardinal sin of the books is like they mix these good healthy principles with overly exciting fantasy. Like, so that can be poisonous mix. You get
Yeah.
like you got like you get like you earn some the reader's trust with the good spiritual stuff, and then you get them overly excited, with the other stuff
Yeah.
or something. But I took the bait, and I still kind of I see the value of the book as pieces of art in a way, as a good literature, but I wouldn't give them as a spiritual advice to anyone. Like I would there's a reason that in Finnish libraries they always you find them in fiction fiction shelves, and there's they are there for a good reason. I think I wondered that over the years that why are these in the fiction bookshelves, and now I'm quite confident that it's a sound such judgment of the books.
That's an interesting question, though, as well, because I think it's true in some West, well, Finland is the West, but in America or in Britain, I think it might also be true that they are ending up more and more in the fiction section. And I think the reason is that the debunking of Castaneda, as I said on a recent podcast, I think, has been quite successful. I mean, there has been a lot of evidence that that the books aren't factual reports. That's been more or less established, let's say. I don't necessarily believe it because I don't necessarily believe when something's debunked, in fact, that makes me trust it more if it gets debunked, because then I start thinking, yeah. I think there's definitely more than meets the eye with Castaneda, but certainly, yeah, they weren't just anthropological reports. I mean, even the idea that he could write notes in his trouser pocket the whole time just seemed ridiculously implausible, right? So there were always anomalies in the accounts, but I think that they were somewhat intentional. And I even wonder, because I like to consider all possibilities, I suppose, but also give benefit of the doubt, if it might have been intentional to some extent. And
Yeah,
Castaneda.
that was always my reaction to the criticism, that like my internal reaction to the criticism of the whatever criticism it has like faced, that like I always felt that he wanted to write the books just like he write it then, like he wanted to write the books like that. And that's why they are what they are. So it's not about being consistent or being like accurate historically,
Right.
but it's kind of expressing something there, and they are like expressions.
Even like a kind of sorcery. I mean, he himself claimed that, and it makes
Yeah,
sense.
that's what he said. He says like himself, like
Yeah.
straight there, that they are intended to make an effect.
Yeah. Which certainly I can validate for myself. And with my life, those books did possess me, for better or for worse. And I'm at an odd juncture now with this. It's probably a fitting time to be talking about it because there's something I've talked about recently as well, which is kind of letting go of beliefs that are particularly conceptual. And I think that's what we're talking about as well with the fantasy element of Castaneda. It's not so much that I know for sure that sorcerers don't fly. In fact, I still probably believe that, and maybe they do. But to me, it's just a concept. It's not going to be a reality in my life, and I don't expect that from Dave either. It's not a world that actually has an allure for me anymore, even though I can still relate to it. I still like superheroes, and part of me is still drawn to those fantasies and the idea that they could be reality. But I'm too old now to maintain the illusion that it's actually ever going to become part of my reality. But at the same time, I'm also discovering, thank God, that it doesn't have to be. That was never really realistic for me. Not because it's impossible, because I don't know, but because it's not necessary. It's actually not part of the path to wholeness or enlightenment. Has nothing to do with superpowers. So letting go of that at a really deep level has kind of cleared the slate for a reevaluation a little bit. And coincident with that, congruent with that, my participation with Dave O'Shaughnessy's thing. And because when I first met Dave, I was still into Castaneda a little bit, although I was kind of near the beginning of my debunking, beginning to debunk or let go. And so I did talk to Dave or email Dave about Castaneda a bit, and he was curious. He wasn't dismissive at all, but you know Dave, and he was generally poking holes in everything and challenging it, and we didn't get into it very much. But then more recently, I've brought up Castaneda again with Dave for a couple of reasons. The main one being that I've had experiences on retreats, kind of more and more on recent retreats, that parallel some of the writings in Castaneda. So it's as though something has come, it's not really come back because it was more of a fantasy, but it's started to become real in a new way, let's say, stripped of all of the adornments, you know, the bells and whistles and the shamanic feathers and all that stuff.
That you say that your experiences in the retreat kind of validate what Castaneda wrote earlier, but you didn't have it as experience until now.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's too soon to say to what degree, because obviously we're not learning to fly on the retreats or anything like that. But and it's not sorcery per se, although that's a big question mark. Yeah, what is sorcery? But
That's semantics.
yeah, semantics. But and I'm hesitant to go into too much specifics because retreats are private and so on. But and this is obviously it's a delicate subject, but something around the way in which human beings can come together energetically and kind of align themselves into a shared intent, which is very central to Castaneda's, some of the later books particularly, and also how I've experienced Dave actually as a kind of Nahal, I guess. Like this, I had this idea about the Nahal. Obviously, Don Juan Matus is a Nahal, and the function of the Nahal in bringing other individuals together. And
I remember projecting that kind of stuff also today. That's or I don't know, projecting, but trying to fit him in the into that role that was like the leading sorcerer from that like yeah from that guy, that set of beliefs or set of view of way of viewing and conceptualizing that kind of stuff, you know.
And it didn't work
So
out.
I had that also, like I tried to like fit him in that or interpret the things that he does through those lenses or something like
And was it a hindrance or a help or neither
that.
or
I don't
both?
know. I don't know. Like it was just my way of, because I had read something and I saw a guy who like did something according to those lines. So I just kind of connected the dots, even though maybe they didn't always fit, but some of them fit, you know. Some of them fit.
I've never cried all my life till I met you, girl. It's simple, oh, you're really cruel. You never see me when I want you to. You got me gone, I got you too. If you're scared, I'll come to the rescue. You know I'm falling in love, girl. I'll pick myself up in the whole world. The way you move, I'm shivering. It's a sea of love that I'm drowning in. Well, you don't know, I'll make it clear. You got someone who loves you dear. I know you're scared, afraid of love, but I'm here to make your heart rise above. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, won't you choose me? Lucy on my mind. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy. me, Lucy, on my mind. Oh, Lucy, ah, Lucy, you got me hotter than the center of the sun. Oh, Lucy, yeah, Lucy, you got me sitting in the cuckoo sweat. Oh, you said, Lucy, you're gonna be mine, but you know that you're not even trying. I sent you flowers just to tell you how I feel, but I still don't know if your love for me is real. I know I'm dramatizing, but when the sun is shining, I think of you. It gets my tongue tied, it gets my mind fried, it gets my eyes wide open. Now I see, so I sing, Lucy, Lucy, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, won't you choose me, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, won't you choose me, Lucy on my mind. Oh, Lucy, ah, Lucy, you get me shivers right down my backbone. Oh, Lucy, yeah, Lucy, you get me hot even when I'm in the cold. Oh, Lucille, what even is your deal? I send you all my love, but then you file an appeal. Am I mistaken? Are you still taken? It seems to me to be the latter of the two. I want you to fly into my arms, untie your chains and show me all your charm. I want you to hold me real tight, I tell you that I love you and that everything's alright. I want you to want me, I'm on my knees just to beg and just to plea. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, won't you choose me, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, won't you choose me, Lucy on my mind. Please, please, Lucy, please, Lucy, please, please, Lucy.
Well, I don't think I was doing that in the early days at all. I mean, Dave just seemed just the opposite of everything I thought I'd been seeking. You know, John DeRuiter was closest. When I fell under John DeRuiter's spell, it was very much like, oh, I finally found the Nahal, I finally found the man of knowledge, because he projects so much power and mystery. And of course, Dave, as you know, is very much, well, at least my experience anyway, is very much the opposite of that, just a kind of very ordinary, affable guy. And so I think that pretty much neutralized from the start that tendency within me. And then, you know, very much a result of my relationship with Dave was letting go of these more conceptual, abstract beliefs. And I mean, it was just a whole process that I was undergoing, a sort of shedding of the skin, the sorcerer's skin, from about 40 onwards, which is when I met Dave, was when I turned, just after I turned 40. So, and I'm not saying Dave was the catalyst, because I don't think he was. I think meeting my wife was much more of a catalyst, but it did coincide with that. And so, yeah, it was a long process of, you know, stripping away all this conceptual stuff. So by the time I was getting involved with Dave, I'd just come through the John DeRuiter thing, which had blown up in my face, essentially. I mean, I really got to see the power of my own delusions and projections through my involvement with John. So that was a crash course, really, in letting go of that stuff. So I think by the time I was participating with Dave in the retreats, I really was ready to inhibit that tendency to try and, you know, make what he was doing fit into my own belief systems. I was really there to get help.
Yeah, maybe you were also you were a little bit older and more experienced when you started with Dave. Like, I'm not 40 yet, I'm 38 as of now. So I'm that bit younger that I hadn't like gone through all of these learning curves. And I like also had to do that kind of I don't know. Like, for me, it's like I said to you in some email that for me, I think most spiritual progress I've lately made, like spiritual in quotes, in air quotes, in I've made in therapy, and also do by doing practical work, like kind of just doing stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it feels like if something that makes most sense, you know, for me lately. But I don't really know, you know, I think I had some strong experiences on like maybe like 10 years or something involved in whatever it is that Dave is doing,
mm-hmm.
or is happening around him. And I don't really have this like clear, I don't have this clear checks and balances about it, like what did I get, or did I get anything, or did I lose time and lose energy, or like like should I have been doing something completely different somewhere else, or was it just the right place to be? I don't have this kind of I don't have a clear picture of that. I would say that was it time well spent. And I listened to one you made this interview with Dave, and then I had these doubts about the whole thing, and I listened to one this interview. It was four parts or something, very long conversation you had,
mm-hmm.
and then I listened to him speak, and like I was like, Well, he's like, he makes a lot of sense. Like, he has point in the stuff that he does, and he makes this spirituality thing, like, he makes it better than anyone else that I ever met, you know. Like, I think he's the best out there that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Doing something spiritual. Like, I think he's the man to go if you're into that, you know. But
mm-hmm.
but lately there's been so little spiritual stuff in my life that it's like, but I think it's because I've had excess of it before,
right?
I had a lot of seeking, like I was trying to like find something, and so I was like hungry. I was hungry, and I'm one thing maybe I'm grateful to Dave is like, because I had this like true believer kind of attitude that I really believe that he's like this enlightened master who speaks the truth and knows the truth. And who knows, maybe he is, but like, he's also just a guy,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's just a guy. And that is like something that I think is quite important. That is the level that you meet. And it's the most, like, if you want to respect another human being, you know, you treat them as an you treat them as another human being, and like and build it from there, and then you can have like better interaction, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was very much how I began an association with Dave. I mean, there were years where I've just interacting as human beings. I mean, my first conversation with him, I said I don't believe you're enlightened. So I was kind of the opposite in that regard. And actually, my point of reference was Castaneda, interestingly enough, to bring it back. I said, I think you've lost the human form. And Castaneda writes about that. and that's not enlightenment. I think you're mistaking two one thing for another. But anyway, I mean, that was my. I actually, of course, did put Dave in the context of Castaneda right away, and saw. I thought I saw. Well, he's not it. You know, he's not a master. He's very far from being a master. But that didn't make me less interested in knowing him. I knew that there was something unusual about him. I'd been trying to lose the human form for decades and hadn't succeeded. So I was still impressed and intrigued, but I didn't put him on a pedestal. I mean, that was back when I thought I was the one when I met when I met Dave. So, and he, as you know, Dave is very. He doesn't put himself on a pedestal, and he does treat everyone as an equal, I'd say, to a surprising degree. And so that was the kind of relationship that I maintained with Dave. It took years before I was willing to turn to him for actual counsel or guidance.
But also, like he's a wonderful guy, but like he's also just a guy, and he's not always right.
No.
And that was like a shock, shock for me, because I was like, maybe I was like looking for a daddy figure or something, someone who would just like, you know, do the work for me. Like you know. I have these problems, and I hope that someone would solve them.
Sure.
Yeah, you know. And it just doesn't work like that. No matter how much we want, like, people have problems, and they have very serious problems. And some of my problems were also like I was uneasy with myself, and I was like. Getting myself in a habit to getting myself into problems, and maybe to some degree still I am, but less than when I was younger. It has thank God it has lessened, but I don't know, like maybe he can help people with that, but only those people who really like do the most of the work themselves or something like that, and then there's someone supporting them, something like supporting atmosphere and supporting energy and like stuff like that.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating subject and a conundrum, even like how somebody who has attained something, whether it's enlightenment or wholeness or peace or however, you know, we from this side of the, of that line we're gonna put a word on it, it's not necessarily going to be helpful, but, how they can help another person to attain it when the nature of the attainment, what makes it real and lasting, is that we come to it alone. We come to it via our own process, not because there's been an intervention per se. And it was an encounter with Dave I had on the last retreat, which came to mind when you're talking about the father, you know, looking for a father. And, because we all do it one way or another, father, mother, brother, sister, whatever, you know, we're all looking.
It's quite human.
Yeah, it's just a part of the human patterning. And
it's surprisingly strong.
Yeah, and it gets very underestimated because it's become a cliche as well, and people kind of think they understand it. You don't understand it until you really experience it.
You have to kind of respect it. To understand it,
yeah,
you cannot be too dismissive about it,
right? And you, yeah, and you've got to experience it, and that means becoming conscious of something that's unconscious. And so for me, with Dave, and we have so many other things, but with this specifically, I would have been aware of that very early on, intellectually and rationally. Again, I had this crash course with John DeRuiter because I really did project all my father's stuff onto him, and I knew it, and then it all went horribly wrong, which is kind of the, when it goes right is when it goes wrong. So, you know, so I went through that rite of passage, and then with Dave, you know, I was that much more conscious of it. But still, with Dave, it took years and years for it to really come to a head, this pattern that you're talking about. Even, you know, as hard as it is for me to project on Dave, who's the same age as me, much more of a brotherly kind of relationship, still I'm going to be projecting those fatherly things onto him unconsciously. And on the last retreat, it did come to a sort of nub, or a, you know, a breaking point, I think, when, and interesting enough, he was talking about my father, and he was saying this thing about my father. He's always said that I'd only got his approval because I'd about movies and writing about movies and stuff. And it's one of these examples of something that Dave sort of latches onto and then he repeats it. But it's not quite right. It wasn't quite right the first time, and then he keeps repeating it, and it's kind of becomes less and less right. And I was in this very emotionally raw state at this point. I was in the cooker, you know, and he said this thing, and I just had this tantrum. I just kind of exploded, and I said, "That's not true. Why do you always get it wrong like this?" And I was, you know, crying like a child. And he said something like, "Okay, but do you want me to get it right?" And I knew right away when he said that, and I said, "No, you're right. I don't want you to get it right."
Yeah.
So it was a very poignant moment, because him getting it wrong was him giving me what I needed, and he knew that, and I knew that he knew that. So it was very paradoxical, because he was actually
there.
Yeah.
The point wasn't like, whatever is between you and him is like, the point is not him getting everything right.
Right, and it's not him being the father that I never had.
Yeah.
It's and yet, paradoxically, that is him being the father I never had, by not doing that, by actually letting me stand on my own 2 feet. So it's very peculiar. It's like just 2 days.
But he's kind of being also just a guy.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. He's just letting himself be just a guy. So this other thing, the transmission, as he calls it, can be there between us. And that's, it's me and my soul, and it's me and the transmission. But that he's aware of it, even though he's not using that awareness to be powerful or have authority in my own psyche, that means I can trust him. And that's really remarkable. I mean, it's awareness is the currency. I've always known that. But awareness is such a very subtle thing. And it's kind of inseparable from tenderness and compassion. And, you know, that it's not a neutral thing, awareness. It's inherently
loving.
Yeah,
it's not. Because it changes. Like, it changes a lot of how you... how you are in a situation.
Yeah, exactly.
With or without, like, how much is there awareness and space to be.
Yeah. And I wasn't prepared for this by Castaneda, or by Strieber, or by Crowley, or by John DeRuiter, or all the other, you know, areas of my exploration spiritually and shamanically. It hadn't prepared me. Because Castaneda is all about awareness, and awareness is the currency, but there's no love in it, not really. It's just power. So it creates this false template, I think, of awareness as this neutral currency. And he even says that, you know, the universe is neutral, and it's all energy, and so on. It's almost a scientific perspective, and it's very cold and ruthless. Those are even attributes of the sorcerer's way, and I took to that because it felt empowering. The idea I could be aware without actually being sensitive and loving and kind. I mean, not to say that I wasn't, but there was part of me that really just wanted power. and
There's like
yeah.
this, like there's this balance because I've been working with animals a lot lately in farms and stuff like this. So you cannot be like overly loving and compassionate with them. Like in not in in a
Right,
hippie sense.
sure.
Like the love that you give to an animal is like you are very clear and you are very decided and you yourself know exactly what you are doing. And
Right.
then you just do it and you do it for the benefit of the animal.
Yeah.
And then he gets it. Like that's the best way to make him get it, that what you are actually doing. You are making you're making like their life better by doing like something very concrete. Like and you don't cause disturbance and you don't like it's just being very very clear and precise.
Yeah.
And that's also the best way to love the animals, not like being overly empathic or overly loving in an emotional sense,
Right.
but just being very clear and very kind of efficient also.
Yeah.
Straightforward and like and sometimes like very silent and calm and sometimes just very fast and active when the moment needs it, but like using the energy in a very right way, like very in communion, you know, in understanding, in coexisting with the creature
Yeah.
somehow in like yeah, you share the space with them
Yeah.
and listen and act at the same time.
Absolutely. I do think ruthlessness does have a place. I don't think it's either or, but we tend to swing from one to the other. We've got
Yeah.
sentimentality, or we've got
And they are like
cold
words,
detachment.
I think they are words attached to like know the word. This is where the words come very short, like they fall short, because it's this like dynamic net of interactions and impulses that can be very smooth. And the word, if you attach them there, these kind of words like ruthlessness or love or stuff like that, it's a poor description of what's actually happening. But you have to have something. And they are maybe there also. Like those descriptions, they are part of the net, but they are just like little impulses of the like big dance. You know, I'm very poetic, but like anyway, yeah.
Yes, we're going.
How do we like describe reality without like mathematics or physics or poetry? You know, we have to try. We have to try to talk.
Yeah, well, I was just saying we're going into the dangerous liminal waters where I end up talking about how language is impossible to communicate with. So,
Yeah, who likes that?
well, I often end up at that place. I think that there's something about language that is useful. It's another paradox in showing us our limitations.
It
So.
is also, yeah, sure.
So we do want to get to the limit, don't we? We want to try and always take words to their limit, so then we have a sense of what's beyond the words.
It could be that they kind of lead us to the ocean side.
Because what you're talking about there, I mean, there's two things come to mind. One is ruthlessness and love, and how these words don't cut it. And one of the reasons, obvious reasons, is that love itself can be ruthless, and ruthlessness can be loving, and so on. So you get words that cancel each other out in a certain sense. But also, you're talking about this relational tapestry of existence, which I've been trying to get my way towards as well, to articulate that existence is relational. Like you and I, we only exist in relation to other things. So right now what exists is the relationship between you and I. That's the conversation. That's how we exist right now, not as, you know, you'll go off and be Panu with in relation to other things, and I'll go off and be Jason in relation to other things too. But right now it's the relationship that defines us, if you will, or whatever, or characterizes our experience. And that's I mean, language reinforces the opposite of that, as in we have these words that supposedly exist as discrete meanings, but they don't. Like, it's how we use words in a sentence, in relation, you know. Each, whenever we use a word, it's different, because it's always in a relationship with other things. So, but the language tends to trick us into believing that things exist separately, you know, rather than in relationship to one another.
Yeah, I think that was what I was like trying to point out with my example, because like there's this resting element. You are a cat person.
A cat person, yeah.
Yeah, you have cats.
Yeah, I have one. Yeah.
So you know that it's kind of, you kind of rest in that knowing that you cannot really communicate anything of value with words to that animal.
Right. You know?
It's kind of a rest for people who are so much like speaking. So you can really use some other part of yourself with the communications. Like, it's more body language and like and sensing, you know, where the other is at.
Yeah.
And I think words are like, for us, it's like they are like these probing devices. we are probing in the conversation. We are probing with these, they're like tentacles or something, like we're just poking with castaneda a little bit and see what comes out, like,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, what gets stirred.
Yeah. So we have to like do something. So this is what we are doing.
That's interesting, because I, particularly when I was trying to understand what Dave does with words, I think I might have dreamt this, but certainly I hit upon, yeah, it was a dream, that he uses words, and that means we do too, you know, we can, like a masseur. And then a masseur, you know, they probe and they poke and, you know, they explore the different parts of the body, and then based on that they determine where to really start going deep, because then you feel the body's responses, and you feel where the knots are and so on, and but also you loosen, you soften it up, and so the more you massage, the more, the deeper you can go into the tissue.
This reminds me of the interview that you did with some guy who I put some feedback on there that I think that you are getting into the good stuff now.
Oh yeah,
you remember that?
Yes. Oh yeah,
and
I
that
know,
was the time you were talking about, like, that you had been mapping hell.
Right.
That all the work that you had done before was mapping hell, and then, like, I had this feeling that now you're starting to map reality. You know.
Hmm.
And that was what I liked. And that's a little bit what I was saying, was also that this poking with words and massaging like the like trying to map out reality, and it mapping like hell or mapping heaven can be like interesting to some point, but like there's like mapping reality, it's just the best thing to do. Like, it's just the most interesting stuff. For me, at least, you know, there's different audiences for different things.
Well, so you're talking about when it becomes less conceptual and more
yeah, maybe
experiential, perhaps.
And it could be like it's more inclusive and not so exclusive. It's more inclusive that in reality there is the heaven and there is the hell, but they don't like take, they don't take over. They are there. They are there as potentials, but there's that this wide spectrum of of the stuff between them, and also like I was saying about this like kind of field of experience of like, you know, life. So I had this feeling that kind of that there was this like broadening of, but now I'm like, I'm referring back to like some interview that you did few podcasts ago, so.
Sure, but the timing, I mean, one of the reasons that I was able to articulate that, that mapping hell, was because it was after the last retreat on which something was expressed to me, or something came clear to me about that, that I understood better like what my life has been about until now, and that was because I was seeing the end of a whole phase of my life, like a mission that had been accomplished. Okay, now you've mapped hell, good. So I say, now you can start living. And what is that? I mean, we were talking about the body, and I was thinking, well, maybe hell in this sense is the trauma in the body, which is all the knots in the body. So I had to, you know, really massage out all those knots, and that was getting the lay of the land of my own body, you know, all the stuff that had been installed in it that was making it hell.
I think we all have our personal ways of doing that stuff. Like, I think going something through in just therapy sessions with me, maybe I was primed with something I was in like doing in Dave's teaching and the things that he already said, like maybe that prepped me. But I think I really effectively did that kind of, I could describe it that way, that I mapped out the things that really bothered me in like in a year of just talking therapy. And I kind of, I'm more able to do it at the moment also, if necessary. Like, I have the skill to do it better than I had before. Like I can find out what bugs me, and I can look at it, and then like decide what to do with it better than before.
Sure, yeah. Developing
but
tools.
There's like, my point was like, you wrote a bunch of books, and I think that those were like part of your process.
Yeah, because
so it's like different for anyone, and like I've done also like theater and music and stuff like that as a part of that kind of process.
Well, yeah, and also you mentioned house renovations in your email.
Yeah.
So I've been doing that, and the thrift store and other things I talked about on the podcast. I think it's all it all comes down to how do we interface with the world? It's that relational thing again. You know,
that's true. Like that's like one of my main interests at the moment is the house renovation, because I'm living at my childhood home. And it's this like 40 years old wooden house, which is like cut into a bit of bad shape.
So it's just a bit older than you are then?
Yeah. So it's like, the older part is, it has an older part that is from the 50s. But the house as it is now is from the 70s. So it's like, it's a bit older than I am, but somehow it's also like inheritance, and it's like my family home. So there's like just doing something to it is like all the spirituality in the world that I need at this moment in my life.
Well, I got
And
chills when you're saying that.
it's scary and exciting, but it's also like boring and frustrating and
Oh, yeah.
I've heard you talking about it, so like just like in yeah it can be like very frustrating, and then it can also like be a source of happiness, and contentment. And when you get some part of the project finished and it actually works, and it's like very satisfying.
Yeah.
And I also have had such history with the place that, because I grew up here, so for me it starts to transform, that it's more about today than it's about the past. And I think that's like the aim of any good Eckhart Tolle reader. It's a good practice for me at the
And
moment.
that came about organically because you inherited it. So one of your parents died.
No, it's actually I don't own it. It's like my mom is like ill, or she's like paralyzed, hospitalized. So she owns it, and if she dies, then me and my sisters inherit it. But I'm living here now, and I'm trying to put it into a shape.
Just you.
Me and my girlfriend.
Oh, okay. It's good you got help.
Yeah, and also like someone who just distracts me a little bit,
Yeah.
that I think like different things also, that I get this sense that life is something else also. There's life outside of the building, there's a world out there.
Yeah.
But I get that kind of sense, because there's another person who has her own life, so it helps.
Yeah, well, I've talked quite a lot about the renovation. I don't want to repeat myself. I always have written about it in Prisoner Infinity, but it is it continues to be an area of fascination to me, like how we kind of know what we need at a certain time, but we can't bring it about consciously. Unless we're going to be sorcerers. I mean, I kind of want to tie this back to Castaneda or whatever you were talking about before, like the conceptual route to wholeness or enlightenment, and why it doesn't work, I think, generally speaking, is that we're always going to be unconsciously driven by the trauma that we're supposedly healing. So we'll find ways to actually avoid a really fully integrating experience, if we're trying to do it through these conceptual means. And as I was doing for decades, and when we bought this house, it was so ugly and so horrible that even the estate agent didn't want to show it to us. We had to bribe the drug users to let us in. There was every reason just to turn away, but we had actually we'd even done a tarot reading, so there was a bit of sorcery in there, but. And the tarot reading has really confirmed, yeah, this house is a means for me to fully enter into my own autonomy or my own authority. I remember there was an Aries card, and I'm an Aries, so I had this kind of symbolic understanding of it, but it was mostly intuitive. It was just a feeling when we did get into the house that, as ugly and as horrible and as toxic as it was, that the challenge was rightly measured to our capacities, right? And so something about that was very appealing. Like, yes, this might seem foolish to some people, but we can do it. We know we can do it, so let's do it. Obviously, we're going to save some money. It was very cheap. So we embarked upon it, and. No, we didn't really have much of an idea what we were taking on. And we were only dimly aware, I think, of how healing it might be psychologically. I mean, there was definitely some sense that this would be psychologically helpful to renovate this house, but it was only by actually doing it. And even now, years later, I'm just starting to paint the back of the side of the house. So I'm actually revisiting this whole experience of what it means to own a house and take pride in it and give love to it and to transform it, to restore it in a certain way, as a way to communicate something to myself somehow, that this is a way to treasure my own body, my own existence here, the physical world, to collaborate with the physical and to cooperate with it and to let it teach me. Right? There's
You speak such beautiful words in about like such a mundane thing as
yeah.
preparing a
And
house.
something so frustrating
And but amen, but amen to that. Like I concur. Like it's exactly like I wouldn't want to be anywhere else or doing anything else. It's exactly what I need to do at the moment.
And one of the things I became aware of doing it was when we live in this house, we're going to know every corner of it because we had to tear walls down and we had to go in just getting to know every nook and cranny in order to clean it or to restore it or whatever it was, basically knowing the house inside out. Meant that, as fact, this awareness or attention again, like we have given a part of ourselves to every part of this house. Like our consciousness has entered into every last part of this house. We've made it our own, and that's, I mean, that is a good thing anyway, just about the house one lives in. One wants to feel at home in it. But also as an extension for our bodies and for my body, like how I hadn't done that with my own body. I still haven't. It was easier to do it with a house. because if it's physically there, right, you can actually approach it in a very methodical, literal way, in a way I can't with my own body. Like I don't know how to put my consciousness into every part of my body. I can try, but it's, you know, it's not a question of will or desire alone. So I think that actually working on the house, well, I know, really, I think I know, that while I was working on the house, something was changing in the relationship between my consciousness and my body. My consciousness was becoming more and more in my body by the act of working on the house, which makes sense, because, I mean, even just hammering and sawing and nailing all day long, I've got to be more in my body, otherwise I'll have an accident. It actually forces you to get more present physically.
Yeah, and so and also one thing for me has been also to accept the idea that I am the guy doing this thing. No, I think that this somehow relates to the castaneda and also some forms of spirituality too. That I think I've always like had these escapist, these fantasies of like, I should be doing this and be becoming something. I should be going in a certain direction and becoming something.
Mm.
I don't know, something great. Yeah. But I think lately I've been lucky enough to let go some of that and just accept that, no, I'm just this guy doing this. Like I'm working in farms. Sometimes I'm doing something artsy, but I'm like doing this farm stuff, and then I'm doing this house stuff, and there's plenty of like life there for me, you know, and that's a really good place for me to be.
Yeah,
and I think I never had this acceptance before. I think I had the idea of the acceptance, but not the actual acceptance.
Right.
I had the idea that I should have acceptance, but like, yeah, of course, like this, because the process is still going. I'm like hoping sometimes that I would be somewhere else, so it would be a bit easier. But that's just part of the process.
Well, it's part of the process actually finding yourself enjoying things that you didn't think that you would enjoy.
Yeah.
Because that's been, like, as you know, as a listener of the podcast and whatnot, you, as you said, you know a lot more about my interior life than I know about yours.
I that's just an assumption.
Well, it's a reasonable assumption, because I'm pretty much an open book, but it's a reasonable assumption that there's affinities there, that actually some of the things that draw you to me are because you share them, right? And so you just said this desire to become something great has been so central in my life, like driving me from childhood onwards. Where was I going with that? Whether it was a super shaman apprenticing under a narwhal, or whether it was a Hollywood screenwriter who'd end up making movies with Johnny Depp, you know, had these two profound...
That's like the Fight Club syndrome, you know.
Split down the middle, you mean?
Fight Club, like in the movie they say that we are all brought up to believe that we are going to be movie stars or rock stars, and then when we find out that we are not going to be those things, then we get really pissed off.
right. If we find out.
Yeah.
I mean,
if we are sane enough to find out.
Yeah, you can keep dreaming till you're 80, I suppose. But yeah.
So I'm wondering that how much this is like a wide experience.
I think it is. I mean, I was always thinking when you said about becoming something great, I realized again that this is what I had to realize about being the one, was that me thinking I was the one made me very, very ordinary, because everybody thinks they're the one. It's a bizarre paradox. I might have had a more elaborate mythology I was able to create through for various reasons, prodigious intellect and lots of occult knowledge and all the rest of it, combined in a Hollywood kind of affinity for creating fantasies, combined that I could really go to town with it and write a book and make a movie and all the rest of it. But essentially everybody has, well, maybe not everybody, but it's very, very common, this feeling that we're destined for greatness and we deserve greatness and somehow the world's going to bestow it upon us if we play our cards right. And, you know, I didn't, for me, letting go of that, like I think for you from what you said, there was no way to just directly say, wake up, get real, it's not going to happen, because it goes too deep, right? The only thing that has allowed that has been discovering that actually, as you said, being a guy who's renovating a house, a guy who's running a thrift store, they provided a kind of satisfaction that I would never have expected to find in those things, and that I wasn't getting, and that I'm pretty sure I wouldn't get if I'd even achieved the, you know, the other dreams of greatness that I was pursuing. And that, I mean, that's so evidence-based. That's like, well, okay, what's going on here? And what's going on, I think, so I thought you meant with Fight Club about the split, you know, split personality, is that there was a part of me, the false identity, as Dave calls it, foreign implant or foreign installation is what Castaneda calls it, that was driving me. Basically, I'd been programmed or installed with these drives and these ambitions that when integral or intrinsic or natural to myself, you know, my true self, and they were driving me into all these behaviors, and they've had to get dragged into renovating the house or running a thrift store and just, you know, it'd be screaming, going, no, this is, what are you doing? We're supposed to be a somebody. And get gradually dissolved in that acid, and something else is, while that's happening, is actually going, yes, this actually feels really good. Look, I mean, your body's enjoying this. You know?
Yeah, and you are not really, like, it's also like that kind of enjoyment that you are not getting any praise or blame from it.
Yeah.
Nobody's applauding you.
That's right.
Like, it still feels good.
That's right. It's just from reality itself. The house, if I do a good job renovating that day, I can see, built those stairs, wow, that's really good. Nobody's going to compliment me on those stairs.
I don't
care, because they're my stairs.
It doesn't really, like, if somebody compliments you, it's like, it's nice, but it's not like important.
No.
It's not that important.
No.
And also that if you fuck something up, nobody's going to like even notice it. And the only thing is, like, if you just think that if it needs to be fixed or not, you know, you make the decision.
Yeah, responding to what's necessary.
How serious of a fuck up is it? Does it need attention or not?
This can get tricky if you're working with your girlfriend, however, because I was renovating with my wife, and there were times that I did a job I was happy with, and she came along, didn't like it, tore it down, and I mean, we almost actually, that was put the most pressure on our marriages, pretty much compared to anything.
Yeah, but maybe you are like in a longer term in your relationship, so we are in the early stage. Yeah,
right, so you're being more polite and diplomatic.
Yeah, something like this element of diplomacy is still, it's still there, and I hope to like hang on to it as long as possible, but the years to come will show. So, like, she doesn't know any other kind of life with me at the moment than the one that we are having now. Like, we are getting to know each other.
It's
so
an interesting way.
This is what she's getting out of me. Like, I'm just this guy who just, like, does the things like I do.
Yeah, well, there's a saying I only heard when I was renovating this house with my wife, that it's not really a saying, but it's a known thing that renovating a house together is the acid test of a relationship. That it takes a really strong, solid relationship to survive that.
I think it also like, but it also like builds up. If you build up the house, you're also building up the relationship, because you're building up the house for the people to live in it, you know. You're not just like doing an abstraction, like you're not just making any stuff.
That's
You're
right.
making a home. You're making a like place for you like people to live in, and like that's the, you know, you just want that the roof will hold.
That's right. There isn't
And
much room for.
making an effort for like for the life that you have. So it's also constructive, like it's not just acid, you know. It's not just corrosive. It's just like it's also constructive, or should be. That's the ideal, you know.
Yeah, restoring something.
Yeah, like that's how it feels when at the finest moments. Like it can feel also corrosive at the, like, you
Well,
know, at the dark days.
they can go together, but it's interesting that because I've written all these books and trying, as you said, to become something great, and part of that is wanting to do something that's lasting. I mean, even if it's not consciously, I don't, because I've always believed I was living in the end of the world, so I didn't want there to be a world after I died. So I never had a literal thing of, posterity or going down in history or anything. But still, there's a feeling that you want to write or create something that's really meaningful. As compared to working on this house or building the stairs, if we ever sell this property, chances are, because the house was never in great condition and the inspector said it was demolition condition, that's the official line on this house, is that it should just be torn down to build another one. But we obviously didn't go with that. But point I'm making is that this house may not really serve anyone but ourselves. So it's not as though I feel as though I've literally contributed something to the world or the community. But the feeling is of having done something much more lasting and meaningful in some ways than the books I've written. I had a different kind of feeling about it, that this just felt inherently meaningful to me in the way that creativity hadn't ever quite, I never quite got that same sense of somehow I'll take this experience with me beyond the grave of doing this house.
But it's also like, you can like, on an in environmental grounds, you can like justify renovating a house.
Yes, true.
Because if you make good of those materials that are already there, then you use less materials,
Yeah,
and you don't like
true.
burn the you don't the coal to sum total that is in the wood or other materials of the house is not like going to the atmosphere or anything.
Yeah, and I think those are sort of surface details about the point to something deeper, which is about discovering the right relationship to the environment, to our physicality. That's what I felt, why I had this sense that I could take this to my grave and feel good about it, was that this was a central part of my process by which I entered into the right relationship with reality. I became aligned with reality, with truth. I mean, that's spiritual talk, isn't it? Get aligned with truth. Well, I didn't do it by meditating. It's just like the physical engagement with the world. When you're renovating a house, you can't cut corners. You can't be a fancy artist who's saying, well, I'm just doing it my way, man. You can try, right? And I do that. I do want to improvise, but at a certain point, the wood or the nail or whatever it is will just say no, right? And then you've got to swallow your ego and say, okay, you know, I have to obey the laws of physics now. And that, I think, is very liberating. There's kind of something freeing about that.
It's true. It's true. And it's really nice to just like succeed in a humble way, that you can do something in a very simple way, but it works and it holds. So even if it's not like the most beautiful or artistic thing in the world, but it's like something that enables you to have a warm house in the winter.
Yeah, basic stuff, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I was wondering recently why Jesus was a carpenter.
Mm.
Yeah. Like it, I think there's something in that.
So if he wasn't the carpenter, he wouldn't be Jesus.
That's right. He wouldn't have made it.
He had to have that in his pocket to proceed.
Yeah, it prepared him to get up on the cross.
I always thought that, this reminds me what I thought before we started this. Like I was thinking before we started this podcast, like about Dave. Like Dave compares himself quite freely to Jesus frequently,
mm-hmm.
and that's something that I always thought that's like really arrogant. Like that's arrogant, but then I thought that, well, like if I think that Dave is just a guy, but if you think that Jesus was also just a guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, so then it's not so arrogant, like, you know. But it can be in certain, like, there's a bunch of people who really don't think that Jesus was just a guy.
Sure. Sure. Like,
there's whole cultures based on the idea that he's not just a guy.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Dave and I got into that in our last conversation a little bit at the end. Because I asked him
What did you conclude?
Well, I asked him what Jesus meant to him, and he said a brother. And then we got into the resurrection. He said he didn't think it happened for real physically. And I found myself in a strange position, actually, because I'm not a Christian, but I've somehow invested in the whole idea that Jesus was more than just a guy.
What do you have in, like, you invested in? So what do you have in the game?
That's a good question.
Playing with?
Yeah, good point.
Your soul.
yeah, well, that's it. That came up in the conversation, that the Christian belief is that you have to believe that Jesus was more than a guy to get saved, right? It's not a neutral thing, what you believe.
No, that's heavy stuff.
It's heavy stuff, right? So yeah, it's possible that that's part of my investment, is I think, well, you know, like people on their deathbed, they might as well convert to Catholicism because...
To be on the safe side.
On the safe side, right? So on the safe side, I'll believe that Jesus was more than a guy, because, you know, if he wasn't,
because
it won't matter.
If you are wrong, then you just die, and that's okay too.
Exactly.
You lost nothing.
Exactly. But I think it's probably the other investment is probably that, again, I want to see myself as more than just a guy. And that's also would have been the Christian thing. If you believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God and God the Son, you'll be saved and be on his right-hand side, right? Mm. You'll get to be lifted up if you believe.
Yeah. And that just makes no sense to me at the moment. That is just gibberish, like, as far as I'm concerned. Mm. And that would be also, like, the next thing that a Christian would say would be, like, well... Because you are not, like, there's the Bible verse to it, but the talk about, like, if you talk about salvation to the one who is going to damnation, it will sound crazy talk to them or something like that, if it's in the Bible. So it might be that I'm going to damnation.
be sure and take your map.
You have mapped it. Maybe, yeah. I had to buy your books. You have mapped the place. That's somehow lost with words now, but it gives me comfort.
Mm-hmm. Does it?
Mm. No. I was just making a conversation.
Well, Jesus went to hell too in the myth after he was crucified. Between the crucifixion and the resurrection, he went to hell. So presumably he had some purpose there too. Well, this brings me to the other subject in your email, is about redeeming Lucifer. Because that's also part of my identification with Christ, and being somebody great was, you know, this idea that we have to go to hell in order to renovate hell. There you go.
Yeah, maybe there is like a hint of truth there. Like, there's truth enough that you could believe that.
Believe.
Just enough truth.
Which bit?
Like that you need to go to unpleasant places and do stuff.
Yeah, well, as I said, bring it to the house. I mean, that.
Yeah.
You don't want to just, you know, condemn, that's the word. You don't want to just condemn a property because it's too much work, right?
Yeah. But redeeming Lucifer is like, that's like going to the deep end.
Yes, that's going all the way. That's the last sheep, right? The one that's lost of the 100 sheep.
But I had also this kind of, I was like into black metal and stuff like that when I was younger. So I had this kind of idea that you really need to go into the darkness to find out what's true, you know, somehow. Mm-hmm. I had this ideal that you get somehow like invincible, or, you know, mm-hmm. nothing can harm you because you already went to the worst possible place.
Right.
So you somehow come back on you come back from there like as a invincible character, something like that.
Right.
That's the feeling. And I never had this, like, I never really vocalized it, but that's the feeling.
Right. So that's different from redeeming Lucifer, isn't it? It's wanting to become Lucifer, although in my case it was the same. I wanted to become Lucifer to redeem him, I thought, consciously.
Yeah, yeah.
But it may be that I really wanted to redeem Lucifer so I could become him. Yeah. You see what I mean? Like, the whole idea of redemption was really a more spiritualized cover story for my desire just to identify with the dark and the bad and the dangerous so that I would feel powerful. I mean, I think those two things are very hard to disentangle, aren't they?
Yeah, and it could be also that there's like this very sound idea in the mix, but it can be like occluded.
Yeah.
Because there's like very strong other stuff coming.
Yeah. Well, the cultural programming and conditioning, and this whole thing of the path of transgression and the sociopaths that rule our world and all of that stuff that I've been mapping for so long really does come down to what you just said, I think. There's all these philosophies, methods and practices about what you just said, about people committing the worst acts so that they'll be invincible. That's certainly in the criminal underworld, and I think it's in the upper world of the elite as well. So yeah, we don't necessarily want to have anything to do with any of that except to understand it.
Yeah.
But I think, go ahead.
Yeah, I just, like, for myself, I have to say, like, I moved back here 2012. And I grew up here in the 80s and 90s in northern Finland in a small village. And like last year's, I really understood how profoundly Christian this kind of upbringing here was. And I needed to rebel. I needed to rebel for that, and it was just like there was no other way.
Right.
I just had to do it.
Right.
And I'm happy it happened.
Right, because you didn't kill any cats or do any black magic rituals or anything like that.
I didn't go there. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't go there.
But you could see how somebody would though with that.
Yeah.
On that.
Yeah, yeah, I would understand. I would understand it. Like, I was like, I was interested about these stories about people who were doing stuff like that. But yeah. So yeah, I didn't need that strong of a breakthrough.
Right.
That could have been harmful. Like that could have been. It could have been harmful then.
I was just wondering if there's a theme there, a commonality, because you're saying the number of people who've been attracted to Dave were into Castaneda. And in my case, I had to go quite a lot deeper into this stuff, even as I write about in Vice Kings to Animal Sacrifices. I didn't realize I was doing an animal sacrifice at the time, but I really was. And so I went really deep into that stuff. To try and get free, and I wasn't even raised a Christian, but to try and get free of that conditioning, and Castaneda was central to that. Like, Castaneda isn't overtly black magical, or death metally or any of those things, but it's in there, you know, the bid for absolute power and invincibility, and even sorcerers killing their children to get the power back and stuff. There's plenty of convergences there. And anyway, it's just this common drive, I think, and a psyche that's had this cultural implant installed that is intolerable to it, which is ostensibly Christian, even if it's not Christian in a true sense. Let's say it's not. But anyway, we need to push it out, so we pursue the opposite kind of behaviors, as if to somehow, you know, cancel out the previous conditioning. Yeah, I was just wondering if there was a, that might be a really, it is such a common thing anyway, but it might also be what people have in common who are drawn to Dave, is this common desire to get free of something that's been installed in them.
I think one of the things, and I think that Dave also has to talk about it, is the idea of sacrifice, like animal sacrifice or human sacrifice, which is like human sacrifice is on the center of Christianity.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the interpretation of Christianity that is most widely spread is the human sacrifice version of it. And that's like, I think this is just my theory, but my theory is that it's Roman Empire culture. It's not Christian culture.
Well, they did crucify him, of course.
Yeah, and I think it was like Roman Empire also choice of symbols, crucifix. It's like mafia. Like, you fuck with us, this is what happens.
Right.
Like, no matter if you're son of God, we crucify you.
And
in some sense, I feel that the Roman Empire hasn't gone anywhere. That we are living in Roman Empire times still.
Others have speculated on that. Yeah, Philip K. Dick, most famously. Certainly, yeah, something that the empire that never ended, that just keeps changing its guises. It makes perfect sense, yeah, that it would use Christianity, the very movement that was supposed to be undermining it, to perpetuate itself. I think it's inescapable. We've got the Vatican as the proof, really.
Yeah, that's like, it was Gurdjieff that had this concept of Svarno Harno, that whatever we do, whatever people do to make world better, it will be used exactly. The thing that someone produces that is designed to make things better, it will be taken and used to the exact opposite.
But I think the problem is then in the first conceptualizing something as a problem, rather than just looking at it more neutrally or dispassionately and saying, what is this and why have we created this problem, rather than saying, how can we fix it?
sounds reasonable.
And I mean, I don't know if this is quite ties in, but there is a hidden aspect to Christianity, and it's not particularly hidden, but it's there, which is that it's not about human sacrifice, it's about ending human sacrifice. And this is René Girard's thing, is that Christ was crucified, he was scapegoated, but it's, you know, the main point about Christ is that he was innocent. He was the embodiment of innocence. So we, as a culture, or as a humanity, or a society, we sacrificed what was most good, what was most innocent. And so then we can see then the scapegoat mechanism for what it is, which is the sacrifice of the innocent in order to maintain the stability of a community, in this case, the Roman Empire. So it's basically the source of all that's wrong with the world. But at the same time, how do we override that social, like it's the inception of religion and everything, it all centers around the scapegoat and ritual violence. This is René Girard's thing, not to get too, philosophical, but so the implicit meaning of the crucifix is the opposite also. It's saying this is what we do, and the only way to stop doing it is to do what Christ did, which is self-sacrifice, to be willing to turn the other cheek, to be willing to die rather than to kill, to surrender.
I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that you are going to end sacrifice by self-sacrificing.
Well, not physically.
You're going to end up as a sacrifice.
Well, yes, you might. You might. That's right, like Christ did. It might just keep happening over and over again. But if everybody did
and it,
it
and it has happened
if.
After that, like he didn't stop sacrificing.
No, it didn't. Yeah, no, I don't maybe think anyone
like,
could argue.
Maybe like ritual animal sacrificing has lessened, but like and ritual sacrificing maybe have lessened, but like.
Sure.
Scapegoating and sacrificing.
Sure, but it doesn't mean that the meaning of the sacrifice hasn't reached some individuals. Just because the world hasn't changed doesn't mean that something isn't changing at a deeper level in consciousness.
Yeah, and the way that Jesus has like they take him to the cross, it's a touching story. I mean, it's as a story, it's interesting and it's a good story. So like this. Like there's something to be said about the attitude that is presented in the story that he had, like before the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
He was quite like maintaining the honesty and also this like René, what was the name of the guy?
René Girard.
Girard, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think he was one of the guys, but also said. Some of these traditional thinkers said that that this is the way the honesty has been like presented as a main value in our culture, like honest talk above all.
Mm-hmm.
That could be one of the gifts of like. What was in the character of Jesus? Truthful talk. And why we like value it so high.
And why we avoid it at all costs as
well. Yeah, that could be also like that's a quite traumatic story of like telling the truth, like oh shit, like if I'm going to say what's true, like I'm really fucked.
Yeah.
They're really going to get me if I'm like truthful.
Yeah.
That's true. That was like also connecting to my point before, like that's like mass traumatizing. Like the story can be mass traumatizing if it's used in that way. And somehow I feel that at some level it is being used and has been used that way.
I think so, yeah. But again, I mean, even as with Castaneda, but more so, just because truth deranges people doesn't mean it's not still true.
Mm.
Like something as powerful. I mean, if Christ was what Christians believe he was, or even what Dave believes he was, well, as in somebody who really... Well, what do we say? Somebody who found the truth, what it is to be human, and communicated it. You would expect potentially, anyway, catastrophic results. Just because something that powerful and profound, if it's misunderstood and misapplied,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, it has been. And we had millions of years of hero myths from the Odyssey and Homer. And did I say millions of years? Thousands of years. Well, maybe millions. Go back to
Yeah,
Atlantis.
who knows? There's no witnesses anymore,
Well,
so.
that's true. But I mean, certainly the Christian myth was very different to that. I mean, in terms of a hero story, it broke all the rules. Like, there's not what's heroic about getting crucified? I mean, we're talking about how it is heroic, but it completely inverted the traditional hero story until then, which was about triumph. Of course, Christ did get resurrected, but anyway. And it probably takes quite a long time to really reinstall or install a new program. I don't like the computer analogies very much, actually, but to introduce a new perspective to a culture and society that has been based on hero myths and ritual sacrifice, ritual violence for thousands and thousands of years. It's probably going to take
Maybe,
quite some time.
yeah, and maybe that's also like being like it's a religion for bigger masses, so you need to have that kind of like the hero kind of mythology. It works when you have smaller tribes who are fighting each other
Right.
and maintaining that kind of balance. But if you want to build larger societies that are fairly peaceful,
Yeah.
then you like need more compassionate stuff.
Yeah, passive ones, yeah.
You need to have like it's like part of the evolution. I think that the Roman emperors, they were like practical and they were just stabilizing the kingdom. So they were just looking what's available and they were saying that okay, this Christianity looks quite good if we just lose this part and that part
Yeah.
and focus on this and that part so we can make it like work. So they were just building like they were taking the first steps of globalization.
Right. That's what I was thinking too, the global village
Yeah, they
creates.
were like they were launching the project and Christianity was like part of it.
It seems to have outlived its uses at this point because it's not very highly favored in the global,
Yeah,
mindset.
we see what the years to come will bring.
Mainstream Satanism, apparently.
That sounds so boring, yeah. Satanism, that's all about being against and rebelling. Like that's what Satan is all
Yeah,
about.
free.
Someone who opposes.
Well, who
So.
asserts their own identity against the world, right? Against convention, against society, everything.
Yeah, so what is mainstream Satanism? It's like is there can there ever be such a thing and would there be anything real in it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't necessarily want to get into it because I need to pee soon, and it just sounds like the beginning of a really difficult subject. I did want to bring
Okay.
it back to the body, though, because I've had this unfinished thought for about 20 minutes now, because we're talking about redeeming Lucifer and Christ going into hell and these myths and what do they really mean in a practical way? And your thing about the need to go into the darkest places, it seems to me that that's all kind of very elaborate mythologizing around a very basic practical thing. Necessity, which is about renovating a house. You renovate the house, you've got to go into the darkest places. Get having a healthy body. You want to be able to put your consciousness all through your body. You want your consciousness to be distributed throughout your body, your life force to be evenly distributed through the whole body, so the body can fully live and live a full life. That would
Exactly.
seem to require going into the darkest places, wouldn't it? Because they're the
Like
places.
among the other places too.
Well, yes, but the places where consciousness is not and has never been
Yeah.
would be the darkest ones of all.
Yeah. But you have to like visit that place too, not just like go just there, but you
Yeah.
have to also pay attention to that place that you wouldn't like to pay attention.
Yeah.
But it's crucial to also pay attention to that stuff too.
To which stuff to?
To that stuff that you wouldn't like to pay attention.
Right, and not just focus on where it feels good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that
And
can
also, but
become.
also you need the stuff that feels good
You
also.
do. I was going to say that can become overly driven and obsessive. So I'm just going to
Yeah.
focus on the dark stuff now. Even
Yeah.
psychotherapy can end up there, right? You just end up
Yeah. Yeah.
stuck on the dark past. But it may be that there is a necessary extra impetus to go to hell. If you know what I mean, you do need more courage to go into the dark stuff.
Yeah, you need to like, yeah, you need to little prep yourself. You need to like, oh, okay, I'm doing it. You need to build up a little courage. You
Yeah.
don't need to build up your courage if you're going to lie in your sofa and eat marshmallows or maybe fruit or
I'm
something
glad you
nice
came
and
up with
healthy.
the PG rated version because I was going to the X version of that
That's what I do. I eat
Marshmallows.
marshmallows and fruit.
Well, we're on the same page there almost. I got my Bombay mix and my crisps and I'll watch Mindhunter or whatever. And to me, yeah, that's full on decadence.
I hear a voice that's not my own that tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen.
Is the end of my conversation with Panu. Find a link to Panu's music in the show notes. If you live on the west coast of the US or Canada and you're interested in participating in either an event with myself or with Dave O'Shana, let me know. I am thinking about traveling to Portland, Oregon sometime within the next few weeks, probably late September, early October time, and Dave O'Shana is going to be on the East Coast around that time. So if we could get together enough people to commit to that, then Dave is willing to fly over the US of A from one coast to the other and meet anyone who's interested in meeting him. Same applies for me, except that I don't require the same degree of commitment or numbers even. If I just know there's a few of you and I can set up a book reading, that would be enough to motivate me to make the trip down south and over the border, assuming I can cross it, which I have to ascertain first of all. But this is the first step, is just to send out a signal and see if there's any kind of echo. So if you're interested in either meeting me or Dave O'Shana or both, then let me know by commenting here or emailing me at jason with a u at protonmail.com. As usual, I like to encourage people to read, buy, review my books to support this podcast. This is The Liminalist at horticulture.com/liminalist.
I'm